From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Human trafficking is forcing someone into prostitution or slavery and is a major problem around the world. But it's one of those problems that likely does not get the attention it deserves. To learn more about the global issue, we talked with Mike Hogan, who works for the International Justice Mission, which fights human trafficking around the world. Hogan visited the La Crosse area recently. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked him how the United States compares to other countries around the world when it comes to human trafficking.
Globally, the human rights community throws around several different numbers, but we generally agree on 27 million is a ballpark number of the number of people that are trapped in modern-day slavery. And that's, to break that number down, that's about the size of Canada, the population. And all of us have studied slavery in history and learned about the transatlantic slave trade, the 400 years of history that, you know, ended with Abraham Lincoln and our government ending slavery. But if you add up the sum of people taken out of Africa during those 400 years, there's more people enslaved today than those 400 years of history. It's just staggering. Slavery's not closed. It's alive and well, and unfortunately, it's thriving. In our country, it's hard to say what the actual number is, but I do know that 82% of adult victims of trafficking are labor trafficking victims in our country, but in 56% of child victims of trafficking are labor. So that tells us that almost half of kids that are, you know, trafficked, it's for sexual exploitation, which, I mean, that's atrocious that kids are being trafficked into this industry of rape for profit.
Of that 27 million, are there estimates what divides out with slavery itself and what is sexual slavery?
It's hard to say exactly. Sex slavery is a much smaller number. The UN estimates less than 2 million children are trafficked into the global industry of rape for profit every year. The vast majority is definitely labor, but sex trafficking is still a significant portion of that. And that gets a lot of good attention in the last couple of years.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your organization, the International Justice Mission. What does it do?
Well, we are a human rights organization. We have 17 offices around the world, and we are working with governments in countries like India, Thailand, Cambodia, or we have in Africa as well and in Latin America. And we partner with the government to enforce laws that are on the books, but they're not being enforced. So on our staff in these offices, we have social workers that provide aftercare for victims of slavery. We have investigators that actually will go undercover and gather evidence to find where instances of abuse are happening. And we have lawyers that will actually assist with prosecution, or in some cases, and in some countries, we're actually able to do the prosecution of perpetrators. So an example, we'll have a case where we'll gather the evidence from our investigators. We'll take that to local law enforcement. We'll go with local law enforcement to do the operation to rescue the victims. The social workers will be there immediately and take the victims to an aftercare. For girls that are in the sex trade, they need a safe, secure aftercare shelter, and they need to be there for as long as they need, for years of rehabilitation, psychological care, trauma counseling, physical healing, getting an education, professional skills. So while that aftercare process begins immediately, but then our lawyers will try the perpetrators, because if you get a few stiff sentences, it sends a clear message to other perpetrators that you cannot commoditize human beings with impunity.
And then what do you do for the organization?
I'm the National Director of Church Mobilization. So I work with churches, students, and local movements of people that are wanting to be passionate abolitionists to end slavery in our world. Here in La Crosse, this weekend, I've spoken at several churches, at three different universities, and they're all passionate people that are interested in getting involved in fighting trafficking and seeing it end in our lifetime.
What are some of the root causes of human trafficking? There must be a reason human trafficking exists.
Yes, yeah. I shared this story at First Free Church here in town. There was one girl named Jyoti, and Jyoti came from a rural village in India, and she was 16 years old, and she simply wanted to help her family out financially. She was the oldest child. And so if you come from a really impoverished community and you're in a rural village, you don't have a lot of opportunity to actually help your family financially other than helping with the subsistence farming or whatever. So a woman came to Jyoti and promised her a job in one of the nearby major metropolitan urban centers. And Jyoti trusted this woman. She went with her. It was all driven by a desire to help her family out financially. They're on the train to the city, and the woman gave her some tea that was drugged, and Jyoti passed out. And when she awoke, she had been trafficked and sold to a brothel where she was serially raped for profit 10, 12 times a day. And she ended up contracting HIV, was forced to have two abortions, and no 16-year-old girl ever dreams of that. So the lure of a job is such a common part of it, and it's such a – poverty is one of the largest drivers in these situations.
Are there efforts to attack that root cause going on that are tied to what your organization is doing with human trafficking?
Absolutely. So the aid world has aggressively tried to fight poverty, and they've done lots of great stuff. You know, there's everywhere you go around the world, there's food programs, there's economic development programs, there's child, or especially female empowerment programs, education programs, schools. Yet still, human trafficking and some of these violent forms of oppression still exist. So one of the key things that we've been seeing at IJM through doing thousands of cases is that over and over, the public justice systems in the countries that we're operating in have broken systems. If historically these systems are leftover, archaic, post-colonial governments, and a colonial government was established to extract resources from people, not to actually protect citizens. So IJM's strategy is if you're going to actually solve these gross forms of violence and oppression, you actually need to transform the public justice systems to function in a way that they're actually protecting citizens. Then, you know, no poverty programs and any type of development isn't going to be successful unless public justice systems are functioning. There was a famous economist, C.K. Perhalid, out of Michigan, and he wrote a book called Wealth at the Bottom of the Pyramid, and he talked about where you see successful development and entrepreneurialism in the developing world, it's in places where the corruption quotient is quite low. So if you show that corruption's low and public justice systems work, businesses want to start. Entrepreneurs want to take risks. They feel they're not going to get their business taken away. So tackling the public justice system, tackling rule of law, is probably one of the most powerful strategies to actually transform tons of other issues like poverty relief, economic development, business development. And at the same time, you're actually making the public justice systems function so that girls aren't going to be trafficked. Or if they are, the perpetrators will be busted and thrown in jail.
Have there been any studies of the perpetrators and what motivates them beyond the money?
I'm not quite familiar if there have been studies, but it's clear as day that money is one of the biggest factors. In most of our perpetrator cases, that's the clear story. But we have some video footage of one famous slave owner outside of Chennai named Kandasamy, and we have him on film laughing and talking about how he's ran his business for more than 25 years on his business model of slavery. And our lawyers in India are incredibly sharp. They found a statute from the British Empire from 1882 that linked the habitual dealing in bonded labor as slavery, and slavery gets a stiffer sentence. So Kandasamy was thrown in jail, and he ended up passing away while in jail. And that sent a powerful message to other slave owners in that area that if we were able to get Kandasamy, we'll be able to get them. So many businesses shut down or legitimized and no longer use slavery as their business model.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. Our guest today is Mike Hogan. He's the Northwest Director of Church Mobilization for the International Justice Mission, an organization that works to help victims of human trafficking. As we record this, he's at UW La Crosse speaking to people about the issue of human trafficking. What has been the impact of the internet on human trafficking, both negative and a positive. I would imagine there's been some positive things about the internet as it relates to human.
That's a great question. I would say, and I have limited experience thinking about the internet's impact, but from the conversations that I've been a part of, the larger conversations around human trafficking, is there's definitely a clear link between the industry of pornography and human trafficking. It's hard to speculate how many, but a lot of girls that are probably on the internet have been trafficked, are part of a trafficking ring in some form or another. It brings the ability to bring a girl from the Philippines straight into one's living room here in the U.S. And and a lot of those girls, you know, don't necessarily want to be there, have been there through force, fraud, or coercion. And so you're able to create more places for the trafficking industry to generate revenue by having it linked to the porn industry. Where the internet's been powerful is that it's actually created huge, like Facebook and all these other tools have created huge abolitionist movements that have helped raise awareness, generate funds, generate a buzz to give people the opportunity to actually do something about modern day slavery. So, it's also a tool to tell stories of where slavery is happening. Without the internet, the amount of advocacy efforts that we'd be able to do in our country and around the world would be incredibly limited. So it's both a powerful tool for social change, but it's been also a tool to expand the issue of human trafficking.
When you think of human trafficking cases in this country recently, one that comes to mind is the Ariel Castro case in Cleveland, and it may not be your traditional human trafficking case where he's making money on the backs of women, but he held them captive for a number of years.
Yeah.
Do we learn anything from cases like that, or is it just like every other news story that seems to enter our being these days? We digest it and move on to the next thing, or is there some long-lasting impact from that case?
Maybe not specifically that case, but you probably have heard more and more of national FBI stings that have occurred in the last year to 3 years. These stings have been shown a success of a model that's being implemented in the U.S. called the task force model. And that's where every major metropolitan area, or most are creating task force. And these task force are made up of the mayor's office, the local FBI, the local police force, the sheriff's department, the local aftercare community, even churches or concerned citizens join this task force to come together and say, let's develop a strategy, a full court press that will fight trafficking in all levels. In the city where I'm from, the commissioner, one of the county commissioners, she increased fines against Johns through that. Like there's all sorts of strategies that are implemented by having a conversation together at the table. So we're seeing successful stings now all around our country because our law enforcement is mobilized in a way that's really effective, and these task force are actually leading to results. About 7 years ago, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation came to IJM and said, we would love to see you guys implement this successful model that's working here in the U.S., the task force model, in one of your countries. So we implemented it in the Philippines in a city of 5 million people called Cebu. And so we brought the mayor, the local aftercare agencies, their local law enforcement, and their FBI, which is called the NBI, there, and developed a full court press plan to fight trafficking in Cebu. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation hoped to see a 20% reduction in the number of minors that are being commercially sexually exploited after 5 years. We had outside auditors come in and do a baseline study to see what is the problem. Well, 4 years into the project, we had those auditors come back and they saw a 79% reduction in the number of minors in the sex trade. This was staggering, incredibly successful. The Philippine government in Cebu was shocked and incredibly pleased that this task force model was working. And now the Philippine government has asked IJM to partner with them to scale this project up to every major metropolitan city throughout the country. So now we're in Pampanga and Manila as well. So the models, there's sex trafficking in our country, but the model to fight it, the task force model, is successful. And now the best practices here in our country are being implemented in countries overseas. And we could literally see a serious reduction of sex trafficking of minors in the Philippines, in a country that large, in our lifetime.
Is there a reason that task force model came into being within the last 1 to 3 years?
I'm not quite sure, like, what drove it. I feel like, I don't really know the history behind it. I feel like it might be one of the strategies of the FBI because they're involved in every one of these task force. But I don't know the history behind how the task force model was created, but it certainly seems to be effective.
Do you feel that law enforcement is doing enough or is starting to do more now then?
Oh, absolutely. I have a few friends. One friend that worked for the one of the police departments in the Seattle metro area, he was one of the guys that would pose as an undercover John often, you know, and so he was involved in lots of these things. He's actually gone on to work and lead our investigation team in Cebu. But he told me people would see the number of arrests in Seattle and say, oh, Seattle's huge sex trafficking area. And he'd say, that's true, but the reason there's number of arrests is because we're doing good police work. And so when you see high numbers, it doesn't mean necessarily the problem's any greater than anywhere else. It means that the police and law enforcement are actually doing their job. They're actually tackling sex trafficking of minors.
Why are church groups so involved in this issue?
The church in the U.S. is really realizing that doing justice and helping those that are oppressed is a really important part of their faith. And so they realize they can't sit on the sidelines any longer. But they need to use whatever resources they have to actually make a difference in combating injustice. And churches are doing all different types of stuff. First Free has a Set Free store where they're selling goods made by former first survivors of sex trafficking in India and in Cambodia. I think they made $12,000 in their first 3 months, and all of that money goes immediately back to help the survivors. And a group up in Eau Claire, Peace Lutheran and Jacob's Well, they do an anti-trafficking run every summer that raises $25,000, $30,000 to support the IJM's work on the front lines of fighting trafficking. We're just seeing churches that are kind of at the forefront of creating local abolitionist movements here in La Crosse, in Eau Claire, in Madison, in Wisconsin, or in Milwaukee. Over 10 churches band together and are creating the first aftercare shelter for victims of sex trafficking. You could look up Exploit No More. That's a coalition of churches that are creating the first shelter here in the state of Wisconsin.
And First Free is a church here in La Crosse?
Yeah, I think it's up in Onalaska.
Some of the information I saw about legalizing prostitution in places like Germany really suggests that that doesn't do much to slow down or stop human trafficking. Does an issue like that, the legalization of prostitution, do much to stop human trafficking?
It's hard for me to fully comment on that. All I do know is that if in areas where adult prostitution is legalized, you're still having children trafficked into that industry. And a lot of times, the adults that even end up getting into that trade, they probably, a woman or a man doesn't wake up one day and say, that's what I really want to do. There's some type of driver that might hint at force, fraud, or coercion, or someone takes advantage of an economic situation that they end up there eventually. But it's probably not the place that they woke up one day and said as a kid, that's what I want to do. So even when it's legal, there are elements of force, fraud, or coercion that are still can be linked to adult legal prostitution. And there's no doubt that child trafficking still occurs in those environments. So my opinion, not the opinion of IJM, but is that it's probably not an effective strategy. And I think the opinion of IJM would be that you need to transform the public justice system to fight trafficking and partner with the government in that process.
How can the average person make a difference on human trafficking?
There's a lot of ways. For fighting trafficking in our own country, now that your eyes are open to it, you actually may suspect or that you see an instance of trafficking. Maybe it's a restaurant where you seem like the labor seems to be being exploited or abused or treated harshly. Maybe it's at a truck stop. You see young girls over by the truckers, where a lot of trafficking happens along the big interstate corridors. If you start to see instances like that, there's a national hotline. You could go to the Polaris Project. Just Google Polaris Project, and they have a national hotline number that you can call. And they are connected with law enforcement all around the country and can connect you immediately with them to report that instance of human trafficking. If you want to fight it here and globally, the best way to do that is, and Americans hate people saying this, but we have great economic resources. So fund organizations that you believe in, not IJM, fund any organization that you believe in that's doing good, effective work to fight it on the front lines. Two more ways. Just tell your friends about it. Facebook, that put on Facebook today, you heard an interview about that 27 million people are enslaved, and see what happens. And then the last thing is that we can all influence our elected officials. Right now, IJM and Polaris Project and many other anti-trafficking organizations are asking people of the state of Wisconsin to advocate, to write a letter, to call Senator Baldwin and Johnson, call their office and ask them to ask President Obama to make fighting human trafficking a priority, to make it a bureau of his executive branch. So that's one step. Just call Johnson or Baldwin today and ask them to put pressure on Senator or on President Obama. The good thing about human trafficking is it's not a partisan issue. We all want to see it end in our lifetime.
You mentioned that early on, the Trafficking Act of 2000. Is that working or starting to do what lawmakers envisioned it would do?
Yeah, it was actually just reauthorized in 2013, largely by the support of advocates all around the country and church leaders calling their representatives, asking them to do something about that. So one of the key things that bill implemented was the Trafficking in Persons report, the TIP report. And that report comes out every year, and it ranks all countries around the world based on where are they at with trafficking. Tier one, they're doing great. Tier two, there's some violations. Tier three, serious violations. And that can affect a country's ability to get loans from the World Bank or the IMF. So Cambodia was an example of a country that was a tier three, and they came and talked to IJM and asked if we could provide some consultation in helping them actually fight trafficking in their country. They've done incredible work in Cambodia. And now it's so much so that their government is so mobilized to fight sex trafficking of minors that our IJM office that's been there for about 10 years that was focused on that is actually changing our casework, because we don't need to be doing the sex trafficking work anymore because the government is mobilized to actually do that. So we're changing to work on another injustice issue there.
You often hear of these cases in bigger cities. But what do we see in the small towns, the lacrosses of the world?
It's a good question, and I don't 100% know the answer to that. I know that communities that are along large interstate corridors, even if they're small communities, can become vulnerable places. The story goes that it's better to traffic someone away from their town. So I could imagine that some smaller Midwest communities might be places for a pimp to target for a brief period to try and get a girl or two and move on. But the vast majority of it is happening in large metropolitan areas, port cities, cities with large interstates, and largely in urban areas.
Mike Hogan works for the International Justice Mission, which works to stop human trafficking around the world. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis interviewed him during a recent visit to La Crosse. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews and photos, and if you'd like to comment on our program or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.